Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, let me just encourage everybody to subscribe to the channel, either on YouTube or wherever you might be listening to it. Also, like the video on YouTube, leave a review on Apple Podcasts, all that stuff. Let people know about it. I really appreciate everybody who's already done that so far. The topic today, as you see from the title, is Why Not Eastern Orthodoxy? And the reason I'm bringing this up is because the last, I'd say, you know, last 50 years definitely, but definitely the last 20 years has been a time of religious movement, particularly in America, people changing their faith traditions, and that's definitely impacted the Catholic Church. The number one way people have left the Catholic Church is just leave the Catholic Church and become nothing. They just don't practice a faith anymore. Some have become Protestants. Within the Catholic Church, a number of Catholics, and we've covered this at Crisis Magazine, have become traditional Catholics. They've become started attending the traditional Latin Mass. We had a survey at Crisis Magazine a few months ago that showed the incredible growth in traditional Latin Mass. And a lot of that is inter-Catholicism. I mean, they're going from one Catholic parish to a traditional Latin Mass, although there's also converts. Our parish has a huge adult conversion class this year. Praise be to God. But one thing that one movement, which I think stays under the radar, and I don't think we have great evidence behind it, but I think we have a lot of anecdotal evidence, a lot of data behind it, I should say. We have a lot of anecdotal evidence, is that a number of Catholics, particularly faithful Catholics, particularly traditional Catholics, are looking to Eastern Orthodoxy. They're looking east with the problems in the Catholic Church, particularly those related to the papacy. Eastern Orthodoxy becomes an attractive option for a lot of people. So to talk about that, I thought a great person to talk with is Eric Ybarra, our guest today. And he is a revert to the Catholic faith from Protestantism. He is an author with two pending books for publication on the papacy and the filioque. I am really looking forward to that. I didn't even know that until you sent me the bio, but I'm looking forward to both of those. And he has spent the last 10 years studying the schism between Catholics and Orthodox. He's a speaker that has appeared on various social media outlets, but is most well known for his contribution as co-host of YouTube's Reason and Theology podcast. He lives in the Midwest with his wife and six young boys. And I didn't know that you had all boys and there were six of them, which the fact that you can get on a podcast, God bless you. I mean, I have seven kids, but six are girls. And let me tell you, my one boy is enough, is a handful. So six young boys. So welcome to the program, Eric.
Now, thank you so much, Eric. I love being here, and I appreciate the intro. You know, you said you don't know how I'm doing this with six boys. Don't be surprised if if I get cut out here, because I've got a few of them running around occasionally against my orders. But if you see my eyes sternly look somewhere, it's right, because I'm telling one of them to get out of here.
Yeah, right. Yes. We all of us with kids who do podcasts, we know how that goes. In fact, I didn't remember to lock my door today. Usually I lock the door just so they can't get in. My wife's here though, so she can cover it. So, you know, we'll see. So, before we get started, some of our listeners and watchers might not be familiar with your work. By the way, also ericybarra.org, and I have it up on the screen, but it's E-R-I-C-K. He misspells his first name. ericybarra.org. You can get a lot of Eric's writings, and they're great. They're excellent. Even when I don't always agree with what he's saying, boy, it makes me think, and it really challenges me. So I encourage you to go to his website, and I'll put in the show notes as well for people. But Eric, why don't you first tell us a little bit about your background? I am interested in the fact that you say you're a revert to Catholicism from Protestantism. So it sounds like you're Catholic, Protestant, Catholic. So talk a little bit about that, but also your interest in Eastern Orthodoxy.
Yeah, the excellent question. So I was born in Miami Beach, Florida. And so I was raised in a Cuban Puerto Rican family. And so naturally I was baptized and raised in the church. And, you know, went to Mass every Sunday. My grandmother had the big Sacred Heart, the picture of Christ's face, the Sacred Heart picture. She had it right above my bed. So every day I woke up, I saw it. And I was always scared because it always looked like the eyes were following me when I went left or right. So I grew up with this sense that Jesus was always watching me.
But, literally.
literally. But, you know, and, you know, I love my family, but we were just, it was a typical, you know, nominal cultural thing. We just went because that was the thing to do. So when I turned around 13 years old, I started reading philosophy books. I started reading books on evolution and atheism. And I just grew very skeptical about everything that was being told to me in the church. And so I remember this transition where I just began to look at the priest up there at the altar as trying to get on a 6-foot ladder to grab the stars. It just seemed like this, you know, how can we know so much detail about it? And, you know, nope, God's not writing in the sky for us to know. And so I just grew in skepticism. So I would just bring books by, you know, Enron. I'd bring books by Einstein on evolution. And I'd read it in mass because I was forced to go. So throughout my teens, I was just an atheist. And but when I went to university in Central Florida, UCF, my alma mater, I ran into a Baptist evangelist, and he got me reading the Bible, and he was my roommate as well. So we would spend hours till 3-4 o'clock in the morning discussing science and objectivity and philosophy and all these things. And he got me really thinking. And so I really had a powerful conversion. It took 6 months, but I just gave up everything, and I didn't want to preserve myself. I lost everything for Christ. I started following him. I went to a Reformed Baptist church. It was one of these churches that we were trying to mimic the early church. So it wasn't one of these churches where, you know, you pray a prayer and you ask Jesus in your heart and, you know, you write the date that you were saved on the back of the Bible or something like that. We were big on repentance, and you had to go through a trial for like a year to see if you were very sincere before they baptized you. So I was brought into a rigorous, you know, Protestant environment. I was there for years. We would go out preaching. I was a street preacher, basically. I was immediately enrolled in going to free speech screens, preaching at abortion mills, getting on buses and asking the driver for the microphone and reading out of Isaiah to the people on the bus. Door to door, we'd go door to door, knocking on, you know, people's doors. And I did that for years, 5 years about. And then a lot of things happened to me, but I started to study history. I started to look for the origins of, you know, who are we to start, you know, telling other churches in the area, because we were pulling people out of different churches, saying, look, that church is not teaching you the real gospel. The real gospel is, you know, repentance and turning away from sin. And so we just, the nominalism and evangelicalism, it brought us into a position where we were dynamically bringing people out of Protestant churches into ours. And we were just this little island of a Baptist church in the middle of Central Florida. So I'm like, we've got to go back to the origins here. And I started to study history, and it really, it started to, you know, take me out of my Baptist, you know, the stricture that I was in. So I spent time in Lutheranism, sat down with a Lutheran priest, studied all the books I could get on that. Then I started walking the Canterbury Trail, as the one famous book says, evangelicals walking the Canterbury Trail. And I started going to an Anglo-Catholic church where I could have all the patristics that I wanted, the sacraments, but I didn't have to stick my neck out for like the papacy or the, you know, some of the stranger things that go on in the Eastern Orthodox Church. So I felt home there. But after studying and praying and seeing some of the oddities in the Anglican Church, it brought me to the fork between Constantinople and Rome. And that's really where I parked. And I think I'm parked. I'm not parked at the fork. I've chosen one path, but I've never taken my eyes off of the path to Orthodoxy. I've always looked at it. I've always reminded myself that I need to take it seriously and never just scorn it, you know. And so I have my study of Orthodoxy and Catholicism. I've been doing it all my adult life. I mean, it's just been so many years now, and I've chosen to return to the Catholic Church, so I'm a revert. But that was because as I was visiting Orthodox churches, I began to study the history of the papacy and the filioque and some of the schism. I chose Rome, but I keep such a sincere discussion going with the Orthodox.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I converted in the early 90s from Protestantism, and I never really considered Orthodoxy. I had no contact with Orthodoxy at the time. But only a year or two, I think it was like 2 years after my conversion, I was at a parish, and the priest thought I might be interested. There was a ecumenical group. It was just Orthodox and Catholic. And he Catholic, both Roman and Eastern Catholic. I don't know why he thought I'd be interested in it. Maybe because I love the history and stuff like that. So I started going to that. That was in Baltimore. This was 1995. And that's the first I really was experienced with the East. I mean, people who are watching can see my icons in the back that, you know, I fell in love with so much of the East. And then we started periodically attending an Eastern Catholic divine liturgy. It never was our parish, and we only went maybe a half a dozen times a year, but we would go because we just loved it. And then we moved. Now we live in an area where there is no Eastern Catholic Church, so we aren't able to do that. But it's been interesting because that's been 25 years now, 26 years. That's just as fascinating me. I've never really had a draw to become Eastern Orthodox, but I just really fell in love with so much about the East. It's so beautiful. And I do think John Paul, to his phrase of breathing with both lungs, I have found, at least personally, that has been uplifting for me and spiritually enriching for me to embrace both aspects of our faith, both the Western. I mean, I always tell people, when I go to the Latin Mass, I'm at home. When I go to an Eastern Divine Liturgy, I love it, but it's like I'm on vacation. I love being there, but I'm also like, but eventually I'm going to go home to the Latin Mass. So it's kind of funny, but you love being on vacation, but
that's right.
Where your home is. So now, okay. So what we really want to talk about is, I think we all know being a Catholic today, a serious Catholic, is a challenge, with a lot of internal things going on, because we're in crisis. And I think a lot of it is, particularly in the past 8 years, has been directed at Francis, Pope Francis. How do we deal with some of the oddities that come out of his mouth, I guess, and his actions, and just some things that were just like, I mean, some of it's confusing, some of it's downright, I would say, wrong. But the point is that particularly those who love the liturgy, the traditional liturgy, something, appreciate the, love the sacraments, appreciate the history of the Catholic Church, Francis is a real challenge. And so people are starting, a lot of people have looked to the East, not just Eastern Catholicism. Some people have done that, which of course is one thing, but they've looked at Eastern Orthodoxy. I guess in a nutshell, why would you just say that's not really the right option for a Catholic?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's, I've sort of voiced that there would be an exodus of Catholics to the Orthodox Church. I think I was saying this right around the time Francis was elected. I think that, with all the emails that flood in with questions about Orthodoxy and all this, I hear it all the time. Eric, I appreciate your work and everything, but I'm making the decision. I'm going to the Orthodox Church. And so I've seen the exodus. Maybe it's somewhat underground, but it's happening.
And real quick to interrupt, if you don't mind. Just your guess, in your experience, and the people who are telling you they're leaving for Eastern Orthodoxy, would you say, do they seem to be, or at least they tell you, mostly traditional Catholic, more kind of just generic kind of Novus Ordo Catholic, or just they kind of weren't really that practicing in that, but now they've embraced the faith and it's Eastern Orthodoxy? How would you break down, if just guessing, the different people that contact you, they're going to Orthodoxy?
Yeah. So the majority, the overwhelming majority, are traditionalists.
Okay.
But occasionally I'll get somebody who, you know, they'll say something like, oh, well, you know, I used to be into Taoism. And, you know, there's some sort of bridge I heard from between Taoism and the Orthodox. So I've heard things like that occasionally, but overwhelming majority, it's people who are thirsting for antiquity.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So then you hear this, and what's your response if somebody says, if somebody just comes to you and says, you know, I'm a traditional Catholic, I'm looking at Eastern Orthodoxy, why not?
Sure. Well, my first response is that, you know, as Catholics or Orthodox, we have to understand that there isn't just one schism between the Latins and the Greeks, or, you know, the Orthodox and the Catholics that happened in, you know, the symbolic date of 1054 and following. That's not the only two claimants to apostolic succession. And those aren't the only two possessors of ancient liturgical practice. So you also have the Syriac, the Coptic, you know, other, we call it under the umbrella of the Oriental Orthodox. And then we have the Assyrian Church of the East, successor to the Persian Christendom. They also claim to have the tactile succession back to the apostles. And they also have a quite beautiful liturgy. So sometimes I'll try to put the question to them and say, well, you know, you're going to go to the Orthodox Church, precisely why? And, you know, well, so a lot of these are refugees. They're just looking for an experience at liturgy where they can immerse themselves in something that's historical, traditional, and authentic. But, you know, if you walk into a Byzantine Catholic church, not knowing it was Byzantine Catholic Church, or if you walked into an Assyrian Church of the East, or if you walked into a Syriac Orthodox Church, or if you walked into one of the Byzantine Chalcedonian Orthodox Churches, you're going to get that experience. So you're going to need to do a little bit more research on which one of those is true. Because if it's just liturgical continuity, then you can't just automatically pick the Greek Byzantine tradition. You've also got other ones. Anybody who lives in the Middle East knows that you've got competitors in this realm. So for, you know, Middle Eastern folks born and bred to hear about American Catholics thinking, well, if it's not Catholicism, then it's automatically the Byzantine Orthodox. That would be like a very premature decision. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have to really study, you know, why did the Syriac separate? Why did the Coptic separate? So I would say that I would push the brakes, in other words. That's usually what I tell them. Hit the brakes. You know, I think this is the horizon here is much wider than you think it is, because there's more options. And if, you know, liturgical faithfulness is there for the picking from more than just one other option. So that's the first thing I say. But if I wanted to get into why I think it's not a choice for Catholics, I would say for two reasons. Number one, the papacy as a doctrine and a tradition is in the arteries of the patristic church, and not just as a organizational benefit, you know. That, you know, when we come up with a pragmatic system to better operate procedure, we could take it or clean it off, destroy it, rebuild it. The papacy as a tradition was always claimed to be authored by the voice of Christ and Peter and permanently fixed in the bishopric of the Roman Church. So that can't be cleaned off from the patristic church, because by doing so, you would be editing the very DNA of the church. And by, you know, editing out that aspect of the church, you're tampering in exactly what you're running away from. You know, you're running away from, you know, you're trying to run away from, you know, Catholicism that's supposedly getting rid of its essential faith. But if the patristic church is going to be a guide for you, you can't go into what they consider the DNA and start taking things out either, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's that. And then also, and the other one is the procession of the Holy Spirit. I think that it's very clear in the church fathers and the script. Number one, I think it's in the Bible. Okay, that's something that Catholics don't always talk about, but the filioque is a biblical teaching. It's not just something that slowly acquired itself over scholastic deduction. It's a biblical teaching. It's a patristic teaching. But the Orthodox have definitively condemned it. And so on a doctrinal level, on a traditional level, the Eastern Orthodox Church is at odds with the Church of the Fathers, objectively. And now, I say that gratuitously. The listeners are very, you know, according to the rule, whatever is gratuitously asserted can be gratuitously denied. Right. Hitherto, my book coming out, that'll be my response. I'm hoping in January my book comes out. So I could give reasons there in the text, but that's my position. I think that if you're going to reject the papacy and the filioque, then history no longer becomes a reliable compass to finding the truth. It becomes a broken compass. North points south, south points north. And so history loses its guiding force anymore. So the Orthodox at that point, they won't even have any impetus in the search, because history is no longer going to have that, you know, force of persuasion. And so I think it devolves to a Protestant revisionism, where you go through history and whatever proves itself false over time, like, okay, everyone believed the papacy up to a certain point, then they denied it. Okay, so we learned that the papacy is not actually a divine institution. Well, what's next? Well, you know, that means that we could scrub out more from the DNA of the church. And so I don't really think the Orthodox position is tenable because of that discontinuity that it has. Now, that's hard to get across, but that's my short answer.
Yeah, you know, I get, yeah. I mean, obviously, these are the type of things you talk with somebody over months and years, potentially. Oh, yeah. But that was great. I want to, the two things I think I want to focus on today are the liturgy and the papacy, because I think it seems like a lot of disaffected Catholics, they start with just the fact that they're tired of the local Novus Ordo Mass that's being celebrated disastrously. And so that makes them look east. And of course, then once they start looking east, then they start having to question the papacy. It's almost, I know everybody's different, but it seems like that's a common path people take. So first, on the liturgy, there's clearly been, over the past, you know, 60 years, liturgical destruction in the West. Yet that has not really touched the East, you know, the Eastern Orthodox. I mean, I know some Eastern Catholics had Latinizations and problems over the years and things like that, but Eastern Orthodox has not had that really like the West has. Why do you think that is, that they have remained, or argue if they haven't, relatively untouched by the liturgical destruction we've experienced here in the West?
Yeah, that's, boy, we're talking like a couple of shelves of books on the, you know. But, you know, I think that the Eastern churches are heavily, they put the emphasis on whatever the fathers gave must be kept. You know, whatever came from tradition must be kept. The West, you know, not just in the last 100 years, but I mean, we're going back to the beginning. The West did feel more at liberty to make reforms, you know. I mean, the East has its reforms, don't get me wrong. I don't want any, you know, Eastern liturgist listening to this to just shut the TV off. But the West was usually more at liberty in changing things, you know, for pragmatic reasons. And I think that with, you know, the history of the Council of Trent following that period, we really felt that, you know, papal power can come down from the top and change, you know, the tradition that not in substance to the faith. And see, that's where the Catholics and the Orthodox kind of differ, because the Orthodox, to them, they don't have like a oh, these are the things that are changeable, and then these are the things that are unchangeable. To them, it's like, no, this is in the wood of what we do. Right. And to scratch at something that may not be at the heart and lungs of the faith, they still don't want to penetrate into the skin, because right. everything's just the right. way it is, right? In some ways, that hurts the Orthodox, but the hurt that they get from it is not visible, especially from a suffering Catholic's
point of view. Yeah, right.
I think the Catholic West, while we just have a clearer line between the distinction between custom or changeable custom and then unchangeable substantial faith. And so that line became much more pronounced when the 19th, late 19th century thinkers are talking about what's going on with the problems spiritually in the Catholic Church. Obviously, that spills into the 20th century with the liturgical vision that came with all the seminary students that led up to John the 23rd and company.
Right.
So I decry the there has been liturgical destruction, but the rationale behind it, I think, was that we just started to think that there's things that we could change without injury, and we just started doing it.
Yeah, and there's a certain hubris to that, that just like it. I'm reading right now a history in Russia and the old believers.
Oh, and yes.
From a perspective of a 21st century modern person, you're tempted to just think these people are ridiculous. Who cares right. if you have two fingers or three fingers when you're making the sign of the cross?
Right.
But for those who aren't familiar, who are listening, the Old Believers is a schism in the Russian Orthodox Church, happened in the 17th century. Yeah, 17th yep. century. And essentially what happened was is the head of the Russian Orthodox Church wanted to revise the liturgical practices so it would match with the Greek ones. And the problem was is they didn't really know what the Greek ones were from the past, so they just did the contemporary Greek ones. And it was like one of the big changes, we wouldn't say that, is that when people made the sign of the cross, they either had two fingers or they had three fingers when they made it. And, holding up two fingers or three fingers. And that was there was other things as well, was enough to cause schism. And so on one hand, we see that, I think all of us would probably say that's extreme. That's obviously not a necessity. Yet at the same time, on the other hand, we do have people today who are saying, and this is a debatable point, I know I don't want to debate it right now, but like the Pope can change anything with the Mass. He can just do whatever he wants. He could I actually put on Twitter at one point, could the Pope abolish all the Eastern rites and make them all go to Novus Ordo? And there were people who said, yes, he could do that. And I was just like, okay, well, now we've gone the other extreme then, where it's just a complete plaything that we can do whatever we want. So we might be careful before we condemn those old believers too quickly. Like you said, maybe they're talking about skin stuff, surface things, but right. like, you know, now we're getting into the heart and the lungs. Yeah. And I think that's what a lot of Catholics see, is that like, what's going to be changed next? I mean, when I was becoming Catholic from Methodist, one of the things I liked was the fact that certain things can't be changed. Right. I knew that I knew it would always be like this, certain things. And so we're experiencing what can be changed.
Yeah, I think that's really what it is. And I'm speaking on behalf of faithful conservative Catholics. You know, like John the 23rd, we might have much to say about him, or Paul the 6th even. But, you know, if you immerse yourself in their writings, you know, they're bent toward tradition. But like I said, they feel more at liberty for the things that they think can change. But then you've got, you know, people who are not bent toward tradition, and they use the posture that we've put ourselves in for their advantage, for a blank check fallacy. Like, what, we can do whatever now, you know, because right. of this. And that is destructive, you know. And I would just simply say that I think we've penetrated through the skin far to, you know, it has injured us. And I think we've given the perception that we're ready to attack the heart and lungs. I would say that we haven't yet. I would say we haven't gotten to the heart and lungs in the Catholic Church. On the flip side, I would say the Orthodox have kept the skin intact, but there's one sword just needed 2 inches to penetrate into the heart when they condemned the papacy and the filioque. And so just by that extra distance, I think they've reached a substantial abrogation. I need to say this. I love the Orthodox. I have many Orthodox friends. I would take walks weekly with a Russian priest back in Florida. And we are still friends to this day. So I have no animosity towards the Orthodox. I don't condemn them out of hand. But we have to be honest right. with what we believe. And so when it comes to business, I have to say what I'm saying.
Now, okay, let's go to the papacy, because I think that, I mean, to a lot of people, the filioque, it is important. I don't want to act like it's not. But I do feel like the papacy is the one that's the more popular division that most people think, like, oh, when you become Orthodox, it's like you get all the benefits of Catholicism without the baggage of the papacy. I mean, it's kind of a common way of looking at it. I have a couple questions about that. First is, you say that, and I just, so listeners know, I'm playing a little bit devil's advocate. I don't necessarily agree with everything I'm asking, but you say the Orthodox have rejected the papacy, but I think they would argue, no, we haven't rejected the papacy. We do believe the Bishop of Rome has a primacy. It's a real primacy. And it harkens back to the early church, the patristic era, but we don't believe in the evolution of the papacy in the West, where it became the centerpiece, everything revolves around it, and that led to eventually Vatican I. It's almost like they're saying, we saw Vatican I coming a millennium before it happened. And we just were like, yeah, that's not the direction we think the papacy is. So how would you respond to that, the argument that they're saying, no, we have the papacy, we accept the primacy of the Bishop of Rome, if he's not a heretic, which they would believe he is, but we just didn't accept the development as it happened in the West.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good question. I mean, it's the more refined position, you know, of the Orthodox, where they don't just take a jackhammer to the history of the papacy. They're willing to say that, no, it was in place, but it came out of place, right? For certain conditions. So what I would say to that is, it is a principle. When something is divinely instituted, like the office of bishop, or the office of presbyter, or the matter, form, and intention of the sacraments. You know, I'm talking about right into the very DNA of Christ's Church. When something is divinely instituted like that, into the blueprints, it's divinely irreversible. So I make a direct connection between divine institution to divine irreversibility. Now, the Orthodox, you know, they have a valid concern when they say, well, I mean, the papacy, you know, the papacy began to teach different things and make claims that were not acceptable to the East. That's still up for debate, right? Scholars to this day still debate that. It's not a given, in other words. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my book, I think I may use 90% non-Catholic commentary when I appeal to scholarship in my book. Just to show that this is not just a thing that Catholics are saying, you know. The East did accept a certain form of teaching about the papacy, which reflects that it's divinely instituted, like the office of bishop, like the office of, you know, mm-hmm. things that are irreversible. So I would be more in tune with hearing what that Orthodox objection, if what they did was, well, we don't believe what, you know, Rome began to believe in the 11th century with the Gregorian reform. So we've reverted to what we used to believe. But that's not what the Orthodox have done. They've reverted in large part to a position where ecclesiastical primacy is something that is reversible. It's not, you know, necessarily divinely instituted. You know, you've got some Orthodox theologians out there that are playing with the idea that a synod has to have a primate and a primate has to have the concilium. But let's face it, you know, who occupies this position and when and how he does it and what are the prescriptions for it? None of those match what was acceptable by the seven ecumenical councils, which was that Christ singled out Peter, gave him a primacy, let's not define it, and that it continues in a single office over the universal church. The Orthodox, you know, by and large, up to this very day, they don't have an institution that looks or resembles even the slightest what they accepted from Elder Rome, they call, in the first millennium. So really, I would be more inclined to see that as a solution. Oh, maybe the Orthodox, they, you know, all they did was just removed what we added. So they reverted back to what was there substantially. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's what they've done. I think that they've taken on a new ecclesial polity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And so today, I don't see them as a progenitor of the first millennium tradition. So if Rome is false, because of its inequality to the first millennium, I think the Orthodox are in the same boat of inequality. And okay. In that case, we're both disqualified.
Right, right.
You know.
Now, I mean, I'm trying to recognize, you know, people wanting to listen to podcasts, because I literally could spend the next 5 hours going through this stuff in the weeds, and it would be a lot of fun. Yeah. Sometime we're just going to have to meet up and do that, and we could record it maybe for people to listen. But let's get a little bit practical in that we currently have a pope who is, I'll use the weasel word, problematic. I would say, I've said stronger words than that. But the point is that, let's be realistic. The Pope seems to be against tradition in a lot of ways. I mean, he has literally said things to that effect where tradition, you know, we shouldn't look to the past. We have to only look to the future. He seems to be thoroughly modern, and I would even say modernist. And I'm not saying you have to agree with everything, my interpretation, but a lot of people definitely think that. And that's why they look to Orthodoxy. And so when it comes to, so if I'm a Catholic, I'm a traditional Catholic, first of all, the liturgy, we've already talked about that, is a problem because my local parish is just, you know, felt banners and kumbaya and terribleness. And then I think, okay, well, Eastern Orthodoxy looks a little attractive. And guess what? They don't have the problem of the Pope that we do. And to be clear here, their ecumenical patriarch is just as bad as Pope Francis, in my opinion. But that's not a problem to them like it is to us, because they don't claim things for the ecumenical patriarch that we claim for the Bishop of Rome. And so it's like, yeah, maybe their guy is a, you know, environmentalist, like all this stuff, like just, you know, all the things he is. Right. But who cares? They can just say that's not a big deal. It's like when a bishop in our local bishop, if he's not that great, it doesn't falsify Catholicism. But if the Pope is actually, let's just say the word, if you think he's a heretic, doesn't that then falsify the whole thing? I know I have about 15 questions in there for you, but try to address them somehow.
Yeah. No, yeah. So here I will level. I'll probably get some Catholics angry here. You know, papal, you know, the big fans of the papacy. So I'm, if I put my cards on the table, okay, if the papacy ends up being something that becomes excommunicable by the standards of Christian history. In other words, in the fourth century, if a bishop came out and said that he believed that Christ was not the Messiah or something like that, they weren't like squabbling, did he say it ex cathedra or did he, you know, no, he just said it and that was it. He was going to get cleaned off the diptychal registry. Right. You know, his name was gone. So I think that if it's true that Pope Francis or any of his predecessors really came out and started to use the magisterial office to basically take the church into a Titanic episode, you know, where the iceberg is apostasy and we're headed to it with, you know, no course of turn. Then I would say that our criteria of verity, you know, our criteria of being the truth has been satisfactorily falsified. Yeah. Okay. And in that case, I would be going back to the drawing board. I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't have an emotional breakdown. I wouldn't try to set up a set of a contest website. I wouldn't do anything like that. I would just calmly say, okay, I'm ready to stop typing in defense of this.
Right.
You know, and I'm willing to be a man with what the facts are showing, right. You know? So I just don't think that has happened yet. But for those who do think that, you know, my door's always open, my ear's always open. I do want to know if that's the case. But, you know, the Orthodox, you mentioned how they don't have that problem, but, you know, so they appeal to the issue of autocephaly, and how, you know, the decentralized nature of the Orthodox allows their immunity to withstand more viruses, right. You know, you know, for us, we've got just one cancerous cell and boom, head to toe, we're toast. Because of how sensitive we are to the papal office. Mm-hmm. Now, the papal office touches every Christian. He's the pastor and teacher of all Christians, you know. So if he becomes defected, cancerous, diseased, whatever you want to call it, we are in the crosshairs. But for the Orthodox, the claim is, well, no, you know, we've got our island here. They've got their island there. And even within the island, we can sort of claim a sort of, you know, quasi-individualism. I can just sort of get the canons and the councils and be my own. I don't think I don't think they have the green light for that kind of thing, though, because it's always been in their books that to maintain unity at the altar with a heretic redounds to their damage. In other words, you can't just go to the altar on Sunday morning and cite the name of Bartholomew and then at coffee hour talk about how this man's an atrocious heretic without carrying the same verdict on your shoulder because you've mixed your bread with him. And the early church always understood you cannot have altar communion with heretics.
Right.
And so you can't say, well, you know, yeah, we say his name at the altar. Yeah, we're technically in communion with Kirill of Moscow, which again, the Patriarch of Moscow, you know, he wrote a foreword to Pope Francis's book on spiritual prayer a year and a half ago. I mean, he sat down with Pope Francis in Cuba, and they both agreed that they wouldn't evangelize each other or proselytize each other.
Right, remember that, yeah.
Yeah, so Moscow and Constantinople, by first millennium standards, they're way off, okay? They're way off. So at that point, I don't think the Orthodox have an epistemological framework that makes them immune to the damage. Now, if an Orthodox says, no, I don't go to church anymore, I just do the divine liturgy in my home, then I would say, okay, well, you're at least being consistent,
right?
Because you're not getting near that altar where Bartholomew or L.P. DeForest or Kirill are being cited.
It's almost like their sedevacantist clause, you know, to do something like that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would not recommend them to go that way. But if we're just talking about an intellectual card game, I would say that their hand is strong. They're right. At least consistent.
Right. You know? Right.
But I don't think they have they can have a good deck, a good hand. If they say, oh, see, you Catholics, you know, if Pope Francis does something wrong, then you're like locked into this problem. Whereas for me, I've got this decentralized,
right.
more fluid. Well, right. no, that, I don't think that is the case because, you know, we might be locked down by the Pope, but you're also locked down by the rule of altar communion.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, they might have some responses to that, but we've always had our responses back. But yeah, I mean, we can go on and on about that, but that would be my short.
Yeah. Okay. Here's where I think I'm guessing ahead of time we're going to have some disagreement. I'm not sure if we will or not. But so you're saying, and if I'm stating your position incorrectly, let me know, that essentially your conclusion by looking at the words and action of Francis is that he has not used the magisterial office to promote heresy, and therefore he hasn't really falsified the papacy because of that. I mean, is that essentially kind of what you're saying?
So, yeah. So let me say this, that, you know, I said before, like in the fourth century, if a bishop came out and said something, it wouldn't even take a dinner discussion for the ball to get rolling. Right. I mean, nobody was even asking if they're using the magisterial office.
Right. Right.
So if I'm looking at this from a fourth, fifth, sixth century perspective, I think the Pope is he's a derelict.
Okay.
You know, he has made statements off the cuff in diplomatic meetings that I've read the text to that are just unacceptable, according to right. I just don't. There's just no way to reconcile it. You know.
Right.
But because, you know, law and government, it gets more complex over time. I mean, even the Justinian's Code, canon law for the Church. From the first millennium to the ninth millennium, things have always gotten more complex. Distinctions have always grown. And so now in the West, we've got this canonical distinction between, you know, a use of the magisterial office
right.
versus a private person or the privatus persona, right?
Right.
So if I'm going to play by the rules, which again, I'm not always happy with them. I wish we would go back to the way it was, where
right.
foul ball was foul ball. You know, but today it's got to be a certain foul ball,
right?
to,
right. Yeah,
to
right.
be foul. So if I'm playing by the rules, which I don't always like, I would say I don't think he's used the magisterial office for that.
Okay.
But don't. I'd rather not answer the question over what I think about his private person.
Right. But ultimately, you would say his private person, if he's in his head, his own beliefs are ragingly heretical. Your point is that doesn't falsify the office of the papacy.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I don't either.
I think that, you know, it gets close to the, like the, you know, fourth century dispute over Donatism. Although I'm not one of those guys that says, oh, we condemn Donatism, so we just have to embrace this. No. That's not what I'm saying. But I do think the legality is too resilient of his office is too resilient. So if he was a private heretic or even a heretic by mistake or some, you know, all the various types of distinctions we have made, I don't think that would falsify the papal office.
Okay. Yeah. And I think, yeah, we're in agreement there. Now the question then is about, you know, his actions. I think, so if somebody does think, that he has declared heresy, for example, in a magisterial way, then that is a real problem for the whole. That's like a house of cards starts to tumble. Now, I just my last podcast, actually, I talked about rethinking the papacy. And my whole point was, the simplistic way to put it would be that I'm trying to move away from papal maximalism to papal minimalism. Not Orthodox papal minimalism, but I mean Catholic papal minimalism, that I would argue that in the development of the papacy, we saw particularly in the 19th century, early 20th century, a move towards, and of course, Vatican I was part of this whole milieu, we saw a move towards this attitude of whatever the Pope's opinions are, we have to go along with them. I mean, I cited some documents, some Leo the 13th, Pius the 11th, where they basically said Catholics need to follow in their opinions my opinions, you know, our opinions, they would say, of course, because he used the royal we. And I just said, I don't believe that's Catholicism. And I think that goes beyond the what the church really, the true teaching. That might be the accepted theology of a lot of Catholics, but that's not the actual magisterial teaching. And I think there's a lot of benefit to going to that more, because it does help us with dealing with somebody like Francis that, okay, yeah, he did say on the plane something completely outlandish and it's contrary to our faith in so many ways. But since it's like, that's just, it's almost like saying, hey, that's your opinion, man. You know, what would you say about that? Like, as far as like the idea of kind of rethinking the papacy, having a more minimal view, or do you think that's more of a cop out? And not really embracing the true full teaching of Vatican I and Vatican II on it.
Yeah, those are good questions. And you know, I'm still meditating on these things. So my answer that I'm giving here, it's got to be with an asterisk that I'm still in process, you know. But here's what I would say. I would say that going back all the way to the first millennium, you've got two mindsets. You know, you've got the mindset, and usually it's the Pope's mindset, that says that the apostolic see cannot be blemished in any way. You know, right. This, you know, a lot of church fathers say that, popes say that. But then you've got a guy like Pope Leo II in the 7th century who says that Honorius stained the apostolic see.
Right.
And so now, and then the way he frames it is he uses his own Petrine authority to say that the chair of Peter has been polluted. I think
is so. Is he cutting his own the leg off his own chair?
Right. So that in other words, the dynamism between infallible capacity and fallible capacity being somehow coexistent was there,
right?
And if it's there, then it could happen again,
right?
So it's undeniable. I can't erase that from the historical record. So you know, the Eric Sammonses, the Dr. Kwasniewskis of the world, I will always give them that there is precedent for this. You know, there's the infallible department, and then there's the fallible department in the office of Peter, right? So we might squabble about that, but I admit that there's precedent for pushing the issue that there's room for this type of thing. But I will say this, that things become clearly ridiculous to me if, and I say that not towards you, I say this to what I'm about to say, I think things can get ridiculous if we're willing to say that the fallible department can become so egregiously large that basically we need to fight against the papacy, and that becomes sort of like the modus operandi for, you know, decade after decade after decade. And, you know, somebody can say, well, there's precedent because we've got the Great Western Schism and all these things. And this is one of the reasons why I'm more delicate to this discussion. And I think I get more delicate as like I said, I was in process. I think I get more delicate as I penetrate deeper. But I will say that I think that Vatican I does really put up a position that the papacy should be a foundational support, and that a crack large enough would basically put us out of business, theoretically speaking, you know. And so I think, but I can't really be specific on that because how much is too much,
right?
So you know, I don't. I think you and I would just still be elbow to elbow on this. You know, I don't really think I have a, you know, well, no, you're clearly in violation because this can't ever happen. But I will say, if somebody says the Vatican, you know, the Second Vatican Council espoused erroneous data, erroneous doctrine, and that since then the popes have all been, you know, binding the church to soul injurious teachings, right. I would say at that point that that's a falsification of
Catholicism. And I think it's interesting because obviously it's just not spiritually healthy for a Catholic to have a lot of his practice of faith wrapped up in being against the Pope. I mean, how is that? I don't see how that in any way is healthy. And I think it's a matter of feeling out, at least it seems to me, of feeling out how far do we go when we see something clearly in what the Pope does that we know is harmful for souls. I mean, we just know it is. We've seen it, and it's just clearly harmful for souls. We can't all just stay silent about it, it seems to me. I mean, it's just like if we all stay silent, then it seems like we're not loving those souls that are harmed.
Yeah, I think it's a false virtue too, because, you know, I've got some friends of mine that, you know, not close, these are acquaintances, I could say, that they're almost like they'll defend Pope Francis by default.
Right.
And you know, that could be wrong because you can't deny reality. I mean, there's got to be a point where reality presents itself so sufficiently that we're doing too much destruction to obvious common sense, you know? Right. And I think that that's not a virtue.
So you're not endorsing Pope splaining, in other words.
No, I don't think that. I know if it's there, it's there, and I think we need to be men about it, right. You know. And I think that you know, dancing around it with what they call mental gymnastics, you know, enough grease and oil, you can grease a continuity out. I think that I try to stay away from that as much as possible.
Yeah, and I think it's a valid point what you're saying, that okay, we in the West like to distinguish our things very carefully, and so there's the infallible and the fallible. So it's like infallible, okay, we won't touch, but fallible, anything goes, and we can criticize and go crazy. And you're saying simply that doing that, like the quantity, eventually makes it a qualitative difference. Like if somebody's arguing that on the fallible side of things, the Pope is basically leading everybody astray and just doing, you know, all this terrible stuff, then eventually that touches on the essence of the role of the papacy in the church. Is that fair to say that's kind of where your concern is?
Yeah, but at the same time, I would admit that, you know, I'm in process of this because what it looks like to me with Pope Francis, it would be like a baseball game where every time a batter got up to bat, he hit a grounder right up the foul line. And it's so hard to see whether it made it inside that the umpires have to call timeout. They got to call New York City. And even then we don't know, you know, so it becomes like an impractical baseball game. So I think under the pontificate of Francis, we're kind of going through that type of thing. So even if it's, even if it, like, technically, all right, it was inside, we're already penetrating at the essence of what we're teaching, because we're saying that the papacy is supposed to be a support, not just barely surviving, you know, or you know, we'll give you I'll give you a bowl of oatmeal a day, son. No, I mean, it's supposed to be a rich defense of the faith. You know, right. Like Vatican I says that he's supposed to guard and protect. You know, you don't guard and protect by getting in with the skin of your teeth.
Right.
You know. Right. And so I'll admit it. So even if I do think that we're still in by the skin of our teeth, I think the imagery is bad because it looks like we're not strong in the faith.
And our Lord talked about scandal, and how right. when we scandalize people, and there's no question. I think that's where I come down, is that the papacy, the pontificate of Pope Francis is undeniably scandalous. And that's why we see, and the very fact that we see people looking to Eastern Orthodoxy, who are, you know, faithful Catholics who have loved the faith of Catholicism, but now they're looking Eastern Orthodoxy, that itself is proof that it's scandalous, because it's not like just like one person's doing it just randomly. It's because of a lot of his actions and actions of other church leaders and Catholics all around. And so the scandal is what led to the scandal of his papacy, exactly. And just, and a lot of things since the past 60 years is why we're asking questions, you know, why not Eastern Orthodoxy? And so
if I may say one thing about that, speaking about scandal, because not many people know this, but many years ago, I was going to go Orthodox. So I started going to an Orthodox church after I entered the Catholic Church. So I started going to Orthodox Divine Liturgy on Sunday mornings and then Catholic Mass on Sunday evening to meet my obligation. And I was cooked. I was cooking up. I was ready to make the transition and everything. But, you know, on the note of scandal you just said, I began to see some things in the Orthodox Church. One of them was the local at the Antiochian Orthodox Church, I won't give the name of it, they had a little festival in the city, and the well-known priest gets up and, you know, he says he's going to have a close friend of his open up the night, give an inaugural address to the evening. And the man who gets up to grab the microphone is my bishop, the Catholic bishop of, you know, of where I lived. So it's like, what I wanted was, I wanted a violent break
right.
from the Catholic Church. And I wanted to go to a place where a hospital for sinners, where they're not going to have anything remotely close to what I despise in right. the Catholic Church. But what I was getting was, akin to, my favorite author is Joseph Ratzinger. You know, if an Orthodox priest tells you that, it's like, and you're trying to run away from
Catholicism, right.
It's kind of like, all right, what's going on here? So that multiplied by all the things we see going on in the Orthodox Church, which you don't know until you get in.
Right.
You don't know until you get in. I realized that I was going to have to give myself the same sort of excuse to be Orthodox that I was already giving myself to stay Catholic.
Right.
So another way, hey, I'll forbear with the scandal because it's the true church.
Right, right.
Well, shoot, that's what I'm already saying.
Right.
In the Catholic Church. So anyway, okay. Go on. I don't mean to interrupt.
No, that's good. I think we're going to wrap it up here because we're getting a little bit long. And this, like I said, we could have done this for hours and hours. I think just any final thoughts you want to give about specifically why Catholics should not be looking towards Eastern Orthodoxy as the solution to what are some obvious problems today?
Yeah. So, I would simply say that what is substance, you know, can't be broken, you know, and I think that we could all admit that it's, we could, lament the posture of innovation that we see in the West. But it's still add up all that. If you add up all that innovation in the West, I don't think that it measures on the balance as much as the substantial excision that has gone on in the Orthodox Church, which isn't visible. It's only visible if you study it out.
Right.
And of course, people are going to criticize my door is always open. You could reach out to me at my website. I take email questions. Look for my book in January. I like to say that, I'm not trying to talk down to the Orthodox. I'm simply a discussion partner, and I have to say things the way I see things. And if I'm wrong, I'm open to being wrong. But that's my answer. If there's a balance here, and the Catholics are suffering by what's happening. When it comes down to keeping the heartbeat going of Christianity, I think the Orthodox have the excision that they've done to the past is too far, even though visibly we look like we're further. Right. You know, right. So I know that's it's going to be difficult to process that, but that's my answer.
Yeah. Okay, very good, Eric. I appreciate it. I want to encourage everybody to go to Eric's website, ericybarra.org, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Look for his books coming up. Sounds like they're coming pretty soon, which I think will be great. I really appreciate you being on here. This is a great discussion, and just to wrap it up, I just want to tell everybody, stay Catholic. How's that?
Thank you, Eric. I appreciate you having me on. This was a blast. Okay.